Good evening. I'm Judy Woodruff on the NewsHour tonight. Countering China. Tensions rise in Asia as the U.S. partners with Australia and the United Kingdom to address Beijing's ambitions. Then, system failure. U.S. gymnasts testify before Congress about the FBI's botched investigation of sexually abusive Dr. Larry Nassar. And fentanyl frontier. The U.S. struggles to contain the flow of the high-powered opioid across the border amid an addiction crisis.
If addiction is always going to be with us, then let's treat it like the illness that it is. When we bring people back to healthy lives, then the demand for the product goes away.
All that and more on tonight's PBS NewsHour. This evening at the White House, President Biden, joined by the prime ministers of the United Kingdom and Australia, announced a new partnership in the Indo-Pacific region. Chief among the announcements, an effort to build nuclear-powered submarines for Australia. The one issue not mentioned by the three leaders, but clearly driving this move, a rising China. Our foreign affairs correspondent, Nick Schifrin, is here with me now with more. And Nick, tell us what it was that the president and the two prime ministers announced.
Yeah, so this was what they called a landmark defense and security partnership known as AUKUS, Australia, UK, US. This is about sharing technology, sharing defense industries, and cooperating militarily. They talked about defending shared interests, but as you just said, they didn't mention China. But this is about defending shared interests against a rising China. Take a listen to President Biden and Australian Prime Minister Scott Morrison, who appeared at the White House virtually.
Our nations will update and enhance our shared ability to take on the threats of the 21st century, just as we did in the 20th century, together. Our nations and our brave fighting forces have stood shoulder to shoulder for literally more than 100 years. Through the trench fighting in World War I, the island hopping in World War II during the frigid winters in Korea, and the scorching heat of the Persian Gulf.
AUKUS, a partnership where our technology, our scientists, our industry, our defense forces are all working together to deliver a safer and more secure region that ultimately benefits all.
This is a giant strategic step for Australia, Judy. I asked Alan Tidwell, who directs the Center for Australian, New Zealand, Pacific Studies at Georgetown, how significant this was for Australia to decide this. And he said it was the most important announcement, most important decision that Australia has made since the early 50s, since the Australia-New Zealand-US Treaty.
This is a significant upgrading of the alliance between the United States and Australia, and a significant statement about the role that Australia envisions for itself and the United States in the region.
And increasingly, that role is a united one, Judy. The U.S. and Australia against China. For Australia, the U.S. becomes closer to them, and the alliance with the U.S. becomes more resilient, and the U.S. Gets an ally that is much more capable of deterring China on its own.
So how is the United States doing that militarily?
This is the premier announcement today, what you said, nuclear-powered, conventionally armed submarines for Australia. This is some of the U.S.'s most trusted, most secret technology. The U.S. has historically refused to provide this technology to anyone, including its partners. In fact, the only time the U.S. has ever shared this technology was with the U.K. more than 70 years ago. Australia currently has diesel-electric submarines, so it's a big investment for them to switch to nuclear submarines. And those nuclear submarines, nuclear power submarines, will allow them to deploy farther, deploy more stealthily, stay in strategically important areas, like the South China Sea, like Southeast Asia, even as far as Taiwan, that China has been using territorial claims throughout that region, as Tidwell said again to me.
And so it could be that one day China decides that it wants to curtail the transshipment of Australian ships or other vessels through that region. And Australia has to protect those vessels. And so what better way to do it than with a submarine? And so I think that, you know, it's based upon, in part, Chinese behavior in the South China Sea. And they have created a problem that is really leaving Australia with very few choices about how it proceeds in the future.
And China has not only expanded its claims in the South China Sea, it's tried to punish Australia for steps it's taken. One, to block Chinese 5G from coming into Australia, and two, calling for an investigation into the origins of COVID. China is Australia's number one trading partner, Judy, and yet today is clearly a sign that Australia is deciding strategically that the future is with the U.S. to counter China.
And as you say, this is a big move that's happening. What do the people you talk to say they expect China to do in response?
They're not going to respond well. This will only reinforce what China already believes is happening, which is the U.S. is trying to contain China using what China calls gangs, as in the U.S. and its partners are ganging up on China. But the Chinese experts I spoke to actually today said, they pointed out that, look, the Chinese-Australia relationship is already bad. China's wrath may actually be pointed to London. Prime Minister Boris Johnson was part of this announcement. China has not punished London economically yet. But even though the experts say that this is a response to Chinese behavior, that the U.S. and Australia are creating this greater military alliance in order to counter Chinese behavior, there is no sign that China has any intention of changing its own behavior.
Significant developments, and Nick Schifrin reporting on all that. And meantime, our Yamiche Alcindor was at the White House in the room where the president spoke, and she joins me now. So, Yamiche, how does this announcement, this set of steps, fit in with all the other international challenges the president's facing right now, in particular Afghanistan?
Well, the president, of course, is facing a number of challenges on the foreign and domestic front. In the room, the president really had this spirit of optimism, this idea that this new agreement was going to be him turning the page a bit and really focusing on what he wants to talk about, which is really working with U.S. allies, as well as, even though he didn't mention China, as Nick just said, also really focusing on how to compete better with China. That said, Afghanistan didn't come up. But there were questions shouted, including from myself and other reporters, as President Biden walked away without taking questions. So that tells you that while the president wants to talk about this new agreement with the UK and Australia, chief among people's minds is still on the issue of Afghanistan and the withdrawal and the chaos and the people we left behind. Another note is on the domestic front, the president also sat down with two senators who Democrats are eyeing very closely. And those senators, of course, are Senator Manchin, as well as Senator Sinema. Senator Manchin, of course, being from West Virginia, Sinema being from Arizona. These are two Democratic senators who Democrats really want to try to get on board on this reconciliation bill. It's sort of what they have been calling a human infrastructure package. It's a $3.5 trillion deal. The president really trying to get them on board. So we'll have to see what happens there. The other thing that the White House tells me is that they're very focused on COVID and talking about that. So this really shows you that the White House does not want to be talking about Afghanistan right now, but it's still, of course, top of mind.
A lot on the president's plate today. Yamiche Alcindor reporting from the White House. Thank you, Yamiche.
Thanks.
In the day's other news, the nation's top military officer, General Mark Milley, drew support for his actions during President Trump's final weeks in office. A new book says that he reassured China that then-President Trump would not order an attack, and that if he did, Milley would give advance warning. President Biden said today that he has great confidence in the general. The Pentagon also defended him.
Frequent communication with two countries like Russia and China is not atypical at all for a chairman of the Joint Chiefs. And those communications are they're routine, they're staffed, they're coordinated, and they're transparent, as transparent as they can be.
Some Republicans have charged that Milley overstepped his authority and have called for him to be fired. The two Koreas traded missile tests today amid rising tensions. South Korea fired its first ballistic missile from a submarine, with President Moon Jae-in looking on. He called it a deterrence against the North. Earlier, North Korea launched two ballistic missiles into the sea. Pakistan is warning that it cannot take any more Afghan refugees. The National Security Advisor says that his country already hosts 3 million displaced Afghans. Members of the Afghan women's soccer team, along with coaches and families, have crossed into Pakistan. They will seek asylum in other countries.
Back in the United States, President Biden carried his campaign for COVID-19 vaccinations to major U.S. corporations today. He met with officials of Walt Disney, Kaiser Permanente, and others, and said many are moving to mandate shots, including one in particular.
The vaccine requirements work, and more companies are instituting them. Even at Fox News, they require it. And I'm not being facetious when I say that, but it's interesting that they've stepped forward and done that as well.
To date, just over half of the U.S. population has been fully vaccinated. Some 665,000 nationwide have died from COVID. That is about one of every 500 people in the country. Pope Francis says Catholic clerics should not mix abortion politics with communion. He would not say today whether President Biden and others who support abortion rights should receive communion. Instead, he said the church should minister to them with compassion. California's Democratic Governor Gavin Newsom will stay in office after defeating a Republican recall bid. Incomplete returns from Tuesday's voting and mail-in ballots showed him leading by nearly 30 points. He addressed supporters last night and said it's a win for him and for the people of the state.
I'm humbled and grateful to the millions and millions of Californians that exercise their fundamental right to vote and express themselves so overwhelmingly by rejecting the division.
We'll look at the recall and its wider implications later in the program. Boston voters have chosen two women of color for a mayor's runoff. Michelle Wu and Anissa Asaibe George finished first and second on Tuesday. Acting Mayor Kim Janey lost her election bid. She is the first woman and the first Black person to hold the office. Remnants of Hurricane Nicholas stalled over Louisiana today, dumping more rain. Rooftops torn open from Hurricane Ida last month left people exposed to new downpours. Flash flood watches stretched to the Florida Panhandle. And on Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 236 points to close at 34,814. The Nasdaq rose 123 points. The S&P 500 added 37. Still to come on the NewsHour, why President Trump's continuing grip on the Republican Party means for elections. Why the U.S. struggles to contain the flow of illegal fentanyl across the southern border. A new parenting book draws criticism for its counterintuitive advice, plus much more.
This is the PBS NewsHour from WETA Studios in Washington and in the West from the Walter Cronkite School of Journalism at Arizona State University.
The Senate Judiciary Committee today heard damning testimony from four elite U.S. gymnasts about the FBI's mishandling of sexual abuse allegations against former USA Gymnastics Dr. Larry Nassar. Each criticized the agency and pressed lawmakers to demand further accountability for those who enabled Nassar. Amna Nawaz reports.
What is the point of reporting abuse if our own FBI agents are going to take it upon themselves to bury that report in a drawer?
Today on Capitol Hill, four of America's top gymnasts recounted their abuse by former Team USA Gymnastics Dr. Larry Nassar and the FBI's failure to investigate.
This was very clear, cookie-cutter pedophilia and abuse. And this is important because I told the FBI all of this, and they chose to falsify my report.
USA Gymnastics and the United States Olympic and Paralympic Committee and the FBI have all betrayed me and those who were abused by Larry Nassar after I reported.
The FBI made me feel like my abuse didn't count and it wasn't a big deal. And I remember sitting there with the FBI agent and him trying to convince me that it wasn't that bad. And it's taken me years of therapy to realize that my abuse was bad, that it does matter.
To be clear, I blame Larry Nassar. And I also blame an entire system that enabled and perpetrated his abuse.
Simone Biles, the lone Nassar assault survivor on the 2020 Tokyo Olympic squad, said pushing for accountability is part of why she kept competing.
The announcement in the spring of 2020 that the Tokyo Games were to be postponed for a year meant that I would be going to the gym, to training, to therapy, living daily among the reminders of this story for another 365 days. One thing that helped me push each and every day was the goal of not allowing this crisis to be ignored. That has proven to be an exceptionally difficult burden for me to carry.
More than 250 women and girls accused Larry Nassar of sexual abuse. He was sentenced to 60 years in federal prison in 2017. Should he outlive that, Nassar faces up to 175 years in Michigan State Prison. Lawmakers berated the FBI's botched probe today, including failing to properly investigate allegations of abuse first brought to their attention in 2015.
Dozens of young women lay before Larry Nassar, and he did with them what he wanted, with trauma and terror that will last a lifetime. That pain was preventable. It was needless.
If the FBI did so little in the investigation involving world-class athletes, what hope could an average American have?
The FBI's failures were laid out in a July report from the Justice Department's Inspector General. It found FBI field offices failed to formally document a July 2015 meeting with USA Gymnastics when the FBI first received allegations against Nassar. They waited 5 weeks to conduct a phone interview with one of the athletes who was abused and failed to reach out to others altogether. And that the special agent in charge made false statements and omitted material information in an attempt to minimize errors made by the Indianapolis field office. The special agent in charge went so far as to seek out a potential job opportunity with the U.S. Olympic Committee. FBI Director Christopher Wray called the agency's inaction unacceptable.
When I received the Inspector General's report and saw that the supervisory special agent in Indianapolis had failed to carry out even the most basic parts of the job, I immediately made sure he was no longer performing the functions of a special agent. And I can now tell you that that individual no longer works for the FBI in any capacity.
Still, questions remain about what justice looks like for these women and the hundreds more who say they were abused by Nassar and failed by the system.
All we are asking for is that when a child goes into gymnastics or goes to school or does anything, that they can be spared abuse. And the fact that we've been treated like adversaries by so many organizations and our abuse has been diminished, we've been victim shamed online over and over again, we've been gaslit, we've been made to feel that we don't matter and by these organizations. And I never want another child to feel that way again.
For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Amna Nawaz.
Californians have voted overwhelmingly to keep Democratic Governor Gavin Newsom in office until the end of his term. This in a recall election where COVID and homelessness were big concerns. Ballots are still being counted, but Newsom improved on his share of the vote from his first election 3 years ago. To discuss the results and any lessons they hold for next year's midterm elections, we turn to two writers who both contribute columns to the Washington Post. Perry Bacon, who is in Kentucky, and Gary Abernathy, who's based in Ohio. It's great to see both of you. Welcome back to the NewsHour. Perry Bacon, let me start with you. How do you explain Gavin Newsom winning?
Well, California is a very blue state. So that's the first explanation. The most important one is that Joe Biden won there by a lot, and now Gavin Newsom has. But I do think there was an important thing that happened during the campaign, which is that Gavin Newsom really leaned into the idea that Larry Elder, who was the top Republican who was running in the recall, would be kind of a Donald Trump-like figure for California, particularly in terms of not supporting vaccinations and mask wearing. So I think like once it became a race about, you know, who takes COVID seriously and whether Larry Elder is kind of like a Donald Trump for California, that's what really drove up the no on the recall and made sure Newsom stayed in office.
Gary Abernathy, what's your sense of why Larry Elder didn't do better? He looked more formidable at one point in this campaign.
Yeah, but I think Perry's right, Judy. I think that as soon as you were able to make it a one-on-one race and not just a recall, not just a referendum on the governor, but which one of these people do you want? And then able to paint Elder as a Trump surrogate, as, do you want Donald Trump in California? And in California, the answer to that is clearly no. But, you know, part of me, frankly, is a little bit happy with the way it turned out because I'm just not a big fan of interrupting people and trying to undo the will of the voters before a term is up, whether it's a recall election or whether it's through impeachment or some other means. We need to start accepting election results and understand that people have a chance to weigh in again when that person's on the ballot again at the end of the term.
And Perry, you talked about the role of COVID and some other issues in this campaign. What lessons do you see for Democrats coming out of this recall for next year in the midterms when President Trump is not going to be on the ballot?
I think they're going to put him on the ballot, and I don't mean directly so, but I think if you looked at this race, when Newsom talked about Trump, and that was when his numbers went up and the recall became less likely. So I think that the lesson here is, you know, California is liberal, but it's still, there's still plenty of swing districts that are in the House. For the House, is particularly important who does well in California. One of every eight Americans live in California. So it is sort of important what happens there. And I think if you look at the campaign, 2018, 2020, now 2021, when the Democrats ran against sort of Trumpism broadly in 2018, 2021, even and probably when he's on the ballot himself, I think that has worked. And at least in this case, what didn't work, and I feel like this is unfortunate, Newsom has a pretty good record from my point of view in terms of accomplishing policies, but he didn't really run on those. It looks like that was better that he didn't run on those and kind of ran a negative campaign mostly, because that seems to have worked.
So, Gary Abernathy, pick up on that. I mean, in terms of whether Democrats try to make whatever campaign it is, they try to inject Donald Trump into it.
Well, and again, it's gonna depend on the state, Judy. In California, putting Trump as your opponent is gonna be successful. He's not popular there. In a lot of other states, that's not gonna work so well. Although, I believe the Republicans need to more and more come to terms with the fact that Donald Trump is not gonna be a winning factor for you in a general election. He may do well for you in a primary situation, but when it comes to general elections, a lot of moderate and swing voters are not going to come back to Trump, nor, in my opinion, should they. As you know, I used to be a Trump supporter, but his actions after the election, his refusal to accept Joe Biden's presidency, his role in the January 6th incursion really disqualifies him. But Trumpism is going to continue to be a popular philosophy with a lot of voters, but you just can't have Trump leading it.
So how do Democrats thread that needle, Perry? The fact that, yes, Donald Trump himself may not be as popular, but there's still this philosophy that's got a hold on many Republicans.
So I tend to think it depends on the issues a little bit. Like, I think the Republicans are, if the election were this year and the Republicans were running being skeptical of vaccinations and masking, which I think are pretty popular with most voters, a majority even in a swing state like Florida or in North Carolina. I think if they're running sort of skeptical of vaccines and mask wearing, that's not a great place to be in. If you talk about immigration or other issues, I think that's where it's closer and maybe the GOP position is more popular. So I think it depends on where you are. But I think this sort of like right now in this moment in California, or I think in other places too, in Virginia, I think it's going to be better to be the pro-mask, pro-vaccine candidate, and then the Republicans are in a weak place right here. In November 2022, I don't know if COVID will be the big issue, and I think that a lot of people will be vaccinated, so I think that may not be the issue this time next year, but right now, sort of following the Trumpism into anti-vaxism is not smart.
And Gary Abernethy, you can pick up on that, but I do want to expand on what you ask you to expand on what you said earlier about Donald Trump, former President Trump, hurting himself after the election. How many Republicans do you think are coming to grips with this?
I think more and more, very, very slowly, Judy, are coming to that conclusion. You know, we still see polls that say, oh, wow, Trump has 90% support among Republicans still. But think about it this way. That's 10% that have broken away from him. And that's a lot of votes. I mean, he needs every last vote if he himself is on the ballot. And he'll lose more as time goes by. It's going to be a slow process, but I believe it'll happen.
And we're waiting to hear from him whether he'd like to run in 2024. We will see. Gary Abernethy, Perry Bacon, very good to see you both. Thank you.
You too. Thank you both.
Tonight, the second part of our series on the ravages of the synthetic opioid fentanyl. Last night, we took you to Mexico to see where illegal cartels make it. Tonight, the deadly cost of the drug just across the U.S.-Mexico border in Arizona. Again, with the support of the Pulitzer Center, special correspondent Monica Villamizar and producer Zach Fannin report.
A tall stretch of border wall separates Nogales, Arizona, from its sister city, Nogales, Mexico. Despite the heavy security measures, this area is a main smuggling route for fentanyl and other illicit drugs, both above and below ground. Border Patrol agent Kevin Hecht gave us a rare peek at subterranean tunnels designed a century ago to catch water runoff from Mexico. In recent years, the tunnels have also been used by drug smugglers.
They can tunnel through the floor in here or tunnel through the wall and dig to a house or dig to a drainage pipe in the U.S. And then they come out of the pipe and they might go to a car, might have another short tunnel to the bottom of a car. Where that reflective yellow is, that's the border fence.
Hecht also showed us this more cramped training tunnel where his agents learn how to navigate the land below Nogales. He says smugglers connect their illicit tunnels to the existing ones.
If they know that there's a big long pipe here, why dig this when you can use it? So they'll breach it, and then they'll try and conceal it the best they can, and put the whatever they, like if they cut this out, they'll glue it back in or seal it back in, and then only open it when they need it. And then they'll crawl this to the next point where they don't have any more pipe, and then they'll dig another illicit tunnel.
So far in 2021, Hecht and his team have not intercepted any drugs in the tunnels. The vast majority of drug interceptions, including fentanyl, are caught by officers at U.S. ports of entry like this one in Nogales. Guadalupe Ramirez is the director of field operations for Customs and Border Protection's Tucson sector.
Years ago, they'd make a compartment in the gas tank, so half the gas tank had gas, the other half had narcotics. And then they started going to the quarter panels, they started going to the tires. Now, they're using drive shafts, transaxles, transmissions, even inside the motor. I guarantee you, if you can imagine it, it's been tried.
From August 2019 to July 2020, Ramirez and his officers seized just over 1,100 pounds of fentanyl. During that same period of time this year, they seized twice that amount, almost 2,300 pounds. 80 miles to the east, Sergeant Tim Williams works in a specialized unit for the Cochise County Sheriff's Department that tracks smugglers crossing a rural area of the border.
My main strategy is using this little camera that we have here. It's called the Buckeye. These things allow us to get real-time information about what's crossing and what's not. So we see a lot of like what we call military-aged males, between 20 and 30-year-old males crossing the border.
The team was launched in 2017 and has caught over 400 drug smugglers so far. Their cameras have captured groups of drug mules crawling on the ground, and even this man with an automatic rifle. Just down the road, the border fence ended.
Where we're standing right now is where, in Cochise County, the fence officially ends on our western border. And it doesn't start again until roughly around Nogales, which is about 70 to 80 miles away.
After President Biden was sworn in earlier this year, he signed an executive order that stopped construction of former President Trump's border wall.
Today, scattered pieces of wall and construction equipment dot the U.S. side of the southern border, along with long stretches of fenceless border. Arizona State Senator Christine Marsh's 25-year-old son, Landon, was one of the last year's 90,000 overdose deaths. Since fentanyl is so inexpensive, it has made its way into virtually every illicit drug. Fentanyl is now found in cocaine, methamphetamine, heroin, and even the painkiller Percocet. Marsh says her son took a Percocet that was laced with fentanyl.
He had a, you know, one wild night with a childhood friend, and that resulted in his death. And I contend that a one wild night shouldn't be a death sentence. And he didn't have a habit of taking anything, and I unfortunately know that because I'm the one that went through all of his stuff. There's no evidence of any type of drug use.
After her son's death, Marsh discovered that these testing strips that can tell users if fentanyl has been added into other drugs were illegal in Arizona.
He was the kind of kid who was prepared for everything. I have no doubt that had the strips been available, he would have used it.
Earlier this year, Marsh brought a bill to Arizona's state Senate floor that proposed the legalization of these fentanyl testing strips. It was signed into law weeks ago.
The law was signed on the one-year anniversary of Landon's death. I'm very grateful that there was that tiny bit of, we're going to turn around and save some other lives on Landon's death date.
Next semester is all going to be research, and then I have to do two comprehensive exams.
This is Danielle. She didn't want to give us her last name. She's in her 30s and is currently a graduate student at a university in Phoenix.
I'm supposed to produce a dissertation prospectus, defend it. Yeah, then I get my fancy little cap and I'll be a doctor.
Danielle is probably not the image most people think of when they picture a heroin addict who's been using for over a decade.
I think that there's a reason that people kind of scapegoat the most visible type of struggling person that they see.
Just over a decade ago, Danielle hid her addiction from her employer. The result was so graphic, we are blurring our footage.
I would try to avoid injecting in my arms or somewhere visible. I would inject in my legs. I also wasn't aware that even if I wasn't sharing syringes, that reusing dull needles could traumatize the circulation of my legs.
First, she got a skin infection. She says over time that her tissue damage progressed.
Part of what you see is I have like venous insufficiency now. So without that blood flow there to bring oxygen, the like soft tissue dies and then it doesn't heal ever. If someone had just been like, hey, if you are going to continue injecting drugs, here's some things you can do to prevent this from becoming, a lifelong issue for you.
Danielle wishes she could have received transparent information about how to use heroin as safely as possible. She said she had to suffer because drug users are often stigmatized.
All drug users are pretty much routinely despised, hated, and feared in our society.
Danielle's friend, Christopher Abert, who is also a drug user, is the founder of the Southwest Recovery Alliance. Despite having the word recovery in the group's name, their main focus is to help decriminalize drugs in the U.S. and help drug users reduce harm.
The idea of like focusing in on the drug itself is the problem, and it's not the conditions and concurrent illnesses that accompany some people's drug use that are actually the root of the problem. So if you focus on this idea of this like chaotic drug user who's dangerous, then you lose the picture of the fact that, you know, human beings have been doing drugs for millennium and doing them without what is ailing our society, like right now, death, disconnection, destruction, disease.
The group also laments that fentanyl has flooded the illegal drug market and has made heroin harder to procure.
I can inject heroin about 8 hours later. I will start coming out of that high. And then eventually, you know, withdrawal set in and I'll have to start again. But with fentanyl, it's about 4 hours after I do the shot. So people are having to use more and more and more. Me personally, I would much prefer heroin.
115 miles south in Tucson, the newly elected Democratic County Attorney, Laura Conover, is changing how the criminal justice system treats drug users. Today, that means passing out food aid to her constituents.
We are in and out of neighborhoods that have been decimated by the war on drugs. What we want to look at is a new way forward in making sure that we are not continuing to attempt to incarcerate our way out of substance use disorder.
At the New Jerusalem Baptist Church, Conover is trying to personally connect with this Black and Latino community that's been disproportionately affected by the war on drugs.
Good to see you. How are you?
To get the word out that her office is not prosecuting all drug offenses.
You're talking about simple possession because there's a substance use disorder. We are looking to make sure that we are moving those people back into the medical and behavioral health realm where that belongs.
However, Conover cautions her office is not legalizing the sale of narcotics.
We are talking about high-level distributors, those who are making a profession of causing harm in our community. We have the resources and labor ready to hold them accountable and prosecute them.
For the past 50 years, the demand for drugs in the United States has proven insatiable.
If addiction is always going to be with us, then let's treat it like the illness that it is. When we bring people back to healthy lives, then the demand for the product goes away.
From crack to heroin to methamphetamine to the most deadly illicit opioid America has seen, fentanyl. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Monica Villamizar in Arizona.
Schools around the country are now largely back in person for class, but there's been a jump in the number of students quarantined, and some places are allowing distance learning again. All too often, parents are facing difficult choices. Stephanie Tsai has the story of an economist who is trying to help parents navigate.
Amid the chaos of life with young kids, parents face an endless stream of decisions.
What we let them watch, what we let them eat, what we let them, you know, do.
And the pandemic posed new challenges.
What are their interests outside of technology? I don't really know anymore.
We kind of joked over the summer that she's going to have to learn how to be social again.
Enter parenting guru to the data-obsessed millennial mom, Emily Oster, an economist by training. Her new book, The Family Firm, employs business strategy for parenting choices. Start with the big picture, she says.
You know, write down what are the three top priorities for your family. That's like a very simple thing that can potentially sort of be moving you forward.
For the most important decisions, Oster suggests the four Fs.
The idea is to start by articulating exactly what your question is.
Frame the question. That's the first F.
Frame the question. Think about what your concrete options you're trading off. Second thing is what I call fact finding. And some of that is about collecting data, but it's also about kind of collecting the information your family needs about the logistics around those choices.
Kenetta Sanford's big question, whether to move so that her daughter could attend a smaller public school.
I really wanted her to be in a place where she would have the support that she needed. So is there a better school environment that we could put her in?
Fact-finding included weighing the benefits to her daughter of both choices.
Thinking about, you know, what are some of the opportunities that one might have in a bigger school district? You know, do they offer more sports? Do they offer more classes? Things like that. But I do think that the school district that we are in now, where the schools are smaller, class sizes are smaller, really is conducive to her learning.
Oster's third F is to make that final decision. The fourth F, follow up.
Talk about this again in a year, in 3 months, whatever it is, and see if we want to make a different choice.
In the book, Oster looks at data studies about fraught issues like school choice and what to feed your kids. But unlike for toddlers and babies, the research provides less obvious answers for school-age children. In a few areas, data is clear, however. Sleep is one of them.
Even relatively small manipulations of sleep can matter for kids' behavior and for their sort of memory and cognition. So we've done experiments where they just reduce sleep for like 4 days by an hour. So it's small.
And it made a huge difference.
And it makes a huge difference.
Negative difference.
A huge negative difference. And the other thing is that when kids watch screens for the hour before bed, that is not good for their sleep.
But is all screen time bad? Janelle Spence has five sons.
When my oldest child was an only child, he didn't watch a television until he was after 2 years. I was in the hospital delivering my second son before my parents ever put him in front of a TV. I was like really like, oh my God, TV is so bad. That's what all the experts say. And then like as I had more kids, it was just impossible to keep them away from the television. As that kind of happened, I'm like, well, I don't know why is it really so bad?
It's a question many parents have grappled with, especially during COVID lockdowns.
Every day is kind of a constant struggle of, when do I get my iPad? When do I get to watch television? Can I turn on YouTube?
B, do you have a two?
Carrie Peterson has three kids.
We've all been inside together for the past 18 months, you know, trying to keep one of them quiet while the other one is on a Zoom call, things like that. I've definitely been handing them a device more often than I would like.
Oster says the data offers one simple central insight.
When your kid is watching screens, they're not doing something else.
Right.
And that is the reason to limit screens. But also, most of what maybe people think they know about, you know, violent video games make your kids violent, yeah, that literature is not very good. There isn't a lot of reason to think that the content per se is problematic. And I think it's become much harder in the pandemic. We're all trying to work from home and have a job and like everybody's kids use a lot more screens. And I think one way to think about that is the choices there felt very much like it's screens or it's me yelling at you. Right. To get out of my office.
Which is not good for kids.
Which is also not good for kids, right? And so I think it's much better. Screens are better than me yelling at you. This was the best use of time under those constraints.
Again, it's about the big picture. Carrie Peterson has encouraged her kids to play sports to get them away from screens.
We try to keep them active. It's a balance between how many evenings a week do I want to spend shuttling kids to different activities versus how else am I going to fill the time in the evening when they're at home. If they're just sitting at home, are they going to just be begging for an iPod?
For Janelle Spence, the decision to let her son do travel baseball was a no-brainer, despite juggling four other kids.
He loves it. It's more of a decision of how are we going to get him there rather than is he going to play.
What does that mean for the family, though?
It means a lot of days at the ball field.
Kaneta Sanford's daughter plans to do Lego League in addition to the running group she joined during the pandemic.
It was really about getting her to connect with some kids outside of her school day where they're on video all day long.
That's a key reason to join activities, says Oster.
Some people think about extracurriculars as like a way to like achieve, you know, or like they're a path into college or
enrichment
of some nature. But in fact, when you like look at the literature, the big benefit to extracurriculars are this kind of sense of belonging.
But as the Delta variant causes COVID cases to surge, decisions about extracurricular activities are again taking a back seat, especially for parents of children under 12 who can't get vaccinated.
Great to have you.
As a new school year begins, COVID is top of mind for Kaneta Sanford.
Will we be able to stay in school the whole entire year?
Carrie Peterson is optimistic about her children's return.
We are pretty confident that our kids will be safe in school, and also the fact that they just really need to get into some kind of a routine.
As kids return to the classroom, Oster thinks mitigation measures will be key.
We saw schools operate safely last year with masks, with ventilation, you know, with teacher vaccinations by the end of the year, with some testing. And I think those are all the kinds of things we want to be layering in. And I think we've increasingly learned how important in-person school is, and that really pushes in the direction of making it happen for everybody.
Throughout the pandemic, Oster collected data on schools and COVID. Many parents turned to her for information, but she also faced backlash for arguing against school closures last fall.
It's a policy intervention that's really, really costly for kids and families, and doesn't seem to have a lot of public health benefits.
I've tried to be thoughtful about this. You know, I believe that what I'm saying is reflecting the best evidence that we have, but boy, wouldn't it be better if there was a more concerted, centralized effort to collect some of this information.
And in your case, it led to a lot of scrutiny and even criticism of people saying, Emily Oster is an economist. She is not an epidemiologist. She's not a public health expert or a public education expert. How did that land with you?
In the space of COVID and schools and trading off risks and benefits and thinking about data, you know, those are things that I am trained in. In the space of commenting on COVID in schools, most of this time I was running the database with the most data on that. And so it felt like, you know, I, on the one hand, I'm not an epidemiologist, but the idea of bringing additional perspectives, I think, is very valuable. And I'm not sure that we should say that our decisions will be made best if we listen to only one kind of expertise.
The issues parents face these days are complex, but Oster believes different perspectives and data can help them make their own best decisions. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Stephanie Tsai in Providence, Rhode Island.
Now, a prominent poet confronts private pains and public strains, home and history. Jeffrey Brown has the story for our arts and culture series, Canvas.
More than 20 years ago, the poet Rita Dove and her husband Fred Feebon took up ballroom dancing. It was originally an escape, a bit of joy after a fire had damaged their Charlottesville, Virginia home. Soon, though, it took on new importance after Dove was diagnosed with multiple sclerosis in 1997.
So I basically had to regain my balance. I lost feeling in my fingers and my toes. Luckily, my husband and I do ballroom dancing, and that helped me because I learned a different way of feeling pressure on the floor. It's try to say, you know, when life hands you a lemon, you'll make lemonade, but that's what I was doing, making a lot of lemonade.
Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Rita Dove.
Dove is one of the nation's best-known poets, former poet laureate, winner of the Pulitzer Prize, professor at the University of Virginia, editor of an anthology of American poetry. But she'd kept her condition private until now. In a new volume that explores both her personal health and our collective well-being. It's called Playlist for the Apocalypse.
It's an idea of how to live with a group of poems, have them accompany you through life. So when I was putting together this book, I thought, you know, what are we all doing in this pandemic? We are trying to find ways to live through it. And so these poems were meant in a way as a kind of an accompaniment.
I get the idea of the playlist, but for the apocalypse. So you mean the pandemic? You mean our political situation? What do you mean?
All of the above. But also, I would say that the word apocalypse can mean the end of the days, but it also can mean a revelation or, you know, a resurrection. So there's a little bit of hope in there, too.
The pandemic helps slow her down, she says, to hear this playlist of the everyday and of the nation's history.
Surely there must be something beautiful to smile upon. The umbered blue edge of sky as it fades into evening, the brusque green heave of the sea.
The poem Beside the Golden Door begins a section titled A Standing Witness, of verses on key figures and moments from the last decades of American history up to the present.
Howling at
it ends this way.
Truth would say these are arrogant times. Believers slaughter their doubters, while the greedy oil their lips with excuses, and the righteous turn merciless, the merciful mad. The poem itself is a lament in a way, but it's also a kind of a plea. It's a plea for come, let's come together. I still believe that we listen more closely to a whisper than to a shout. But in the middle of everything that's happened in the past 5, 6, 7 years, and the pandemic, and this
kind of rage was bubbling up in me at such a point I decided, you know, it was unhealthy to hold it in. I better let it out.
Tell me how you think of history as a poet and how you speak to it.
I believe that poets, as I think all artists, you are really connected to the world and to life. And as a Black woman, from a very early age, I understood that there was a history and there was a history. In fact, that mainstream history did not include me or did not look at me as I thought of myself.
Also there now, the effects of an illness that has prevented Dove from playing her viola da gamba and cello. She's a great lover of classical music. It also forced her to relearn to write by hand. That's how she'd always written her poems. Now she uses a computer much of the time.
No reason for it. I just find myself on pause. Paused for longer than is proper. If I were more seasoned, I'd ignore it.
In the poem Blue Straight, Dove addresses head-on some of the pains of everyday life.
The cup of plenty runneth over, ruins my hands. I've scrubbed them, but they won't come clean. Strange, I know, to wish for nothing. A day to live through, a screen.
Dove says she's learned to manage her illness and feels incredibly lucky. And her love of language and its music abides. She writes in one poem of loving every minute spent jostling syllables and then each word caught right.
I wish I could explain the mystery of that moment where everything sparks and starts to come together. But what I love to do is to wrestle with the language, because the language is what a writer has. It's our tool, it's our clay. And it sounds terrifically nerdy, but you know, I'll sit there and debate comma or dash. And, you know, but it has something to do with the music of the words, too.
You've spent a life as really a very public poet, really making a case for poetry out in the world. I wonder what you're thinking about the future. How important is it for you still to be out there in the public, talking to people about poetry, reading poetry for them?
It's really important for me, because what we still don't have in this world, at least in this country particularly, is a sense of true communication. When you sit down and read a poem, what you feel inside is all yours, and yet you can feel that everyone around you is also feeling it. What an incredible feeling. So yes, I'm committed to it. I'm ready to come out again.
A feeling we all share. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Jeffrey Brown.
And we close tonight with a dramatic reopening. Last night, Broadway was back performing for the public after largely being dark for a year and a half during the pandemic. Before the curtains were raised for fully vaccinated audiences, cast members from the musicals Hamilton, Wicked, and The Lion King celebrated on the street with this rendition of New York, New York. So great to have something to celebrate. That's Broadway. And that's the NewsHour for tonight. I'm Judy Woodruff. Thank you. Please stay safe, and we'll see you soon.